the latest agriculture news from across the state and the nation, here's Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Good Wednesday morning, and thanks for joining us today on Farm City Newsday. Well, McDonald's has now jumped on board the plant-based protein train. Last week in Canada, the well-known fast casual eatery launched the PLT, a plant lettuce tomato burger made with Beyond Meat patties. A McDonald's spokesperson said, quote, "We've been working on our recipe, and now we're ready to hear feedback from our customers." McDonald's joins other restaurant chains in providing a plant-based alternative, including KFC, which recently came out with a plant-based chicken product, Del Taco, Taco Bell, Burger King, and Carl's Jr. Moving on to what's happening in today's show, Brian German is talking with us about the CFBF Leadership Farm Bureau program that's now accepting applications. He also has a report on the recent step forward in understanding HLB bacteria. Taylor Hillman has details on tempering off-year expectations for pistachios. And I'm starting off the show today with news on women in the ag industry. Let's jump right in. A new nationwide initiative is empowering women landowners to protect and embrace their land. The American Farmland Trust and NRCS partnered in reaching women in the agriculture industry and helped them overcome gender-related barriers when it came to managing their land long-term. The Women for the Land initiative just wrapped up a focus group in Southern California, where the WFL team heard,
Women landowners need in California to help them implement conservation practices and keep their farm operations viable.
That was American Farmland Trust Kara Heckert. She says that's not the first or the last focus group to hit the state.
We did a focus group about a year ago in Northern California that had a lot of women agricultural industry leaders and women farmers, and it was a really great opportunity to get kind of California-specific needs for the program. You know, we're a very diverse, large state with a lot of different farming systems, and so it was a great opportunity to hear directly from those women on what their needs are.
And what they do with that information is create ways for the initiative to focus on women in ag here in California.
That's exactly right. And especially help us to shape kind of the agenda and subject matter topics of what we call conservation learning circles, which are open to really any woman farmer or landowner that wants to have opportunities to access more resources for conservation practices and farm viability.
And now here's Taylor Homan with more agriculture news.
Early reports predicted a big year for pistachios given the off-year production, but that's looking to be incorrect. American Pistachio Growers Executive Director Richard Matoyan said a few months ago, the off-year crop for pistachio growers looked to be quite large, but as we get closer to harvest, reports are changing that forecast.
This year is an off-year. Last year we had our record crop. It initially looked like it was going to be a larger year for our off-year, but what I'm hearing from the growers is that the fields are a little bit lighter than even they had hoped for. So that's a little disappointing there. The great thing is the nut size is larger than what we've had in the past. And beyond that, quality is real good so far. Low insect damage, which is really, really important to our growers to be able to produce a quality crop.
As Matoyan said, quality and size is good, and that's especially important this year.
Yes, and the major thing with an off year is having the larger size nuts. So just imagine a tree that's not producing as much is going to produce a little bit larger size nuts, which is really important to certain customers that are looking for a particular large size nut.
Reporting for AgNet West Radio Network, I'm Taylor Hillman.
Researchers from Washington State University have made a significant discovery in successfully culturing the bacteria associated with HLB known as CLAS in a lab setting. Chief Research Scientist for the Citrus Research Board, Dr. Melinda Klein, said the ability to work with the CLAS bacteria out of the plant and out of the psyllid will be an important step in formulating materials to combat HLB.
There's issues with making sure that you're consistently putting in enough bacteria and then seeing what the response is. So that's where if you have pure bacteria, you can make sure that you're putting the same amount in to standardize your research experiments so that if you've got antibacterial compounds or if you've got plants that you think are tolerant, you know that you're putting the same amount of bacteria in, and you really can kind of gauge how effective the new variety is or the antibacterial compounds are.
The California Farm Bureau Federation is now accepting applications for the Leadership Farm Bureau Class of 2020. Leadership Farm Bureau is a leadership development program designed to provide perspective and training in personal development, government affairs, and agricultural issues, as well as educate participants on the Farm Bureau organization and structure. Meetings will vary according to each month's agenda, but each session runs approximately 3 days. Applicants will need to be a member of Farm Bureau, and priority is given to those in production agriculture and agribusiness. Applications will need to be accompanied by a recommendation from the County Farm Bureau President, as well as two personal references. The selection committee will base its selection of participants on information obtained from the application, submitted recommendations, and a personal interview. All applications are due by Friday, December 20th. For AgNet West Radio Network, I'm Brian German.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. More agriculture news and farm features are coming up. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City News Day. We've got more agriculture news right now.
Last week, President Donald Trump signed a continuing resolution that will provide funding for the federal government through November 21st. Vice President of Washington Operations for the National Cotton Council, Reese Langley, said that this stopgap measure is vital for the continuation of trade relief funding for farmers.
This is critically important because at this point, Congress has not passed any of the full year appropriations bills for fiscal year 20. As part of this continuing resolution, it restores full funding for USDA's Commodity Credit Corporation, which will ensure that the department can continue to make the Market Facilitation Program payments that are due, as well as Farm Bill, ARC, and PLC payments that are due this fall. Also, the Senate Appropriations Committee approved their version of the Agricultural Appropriations Bill for fiscal year 20. The Ag Appropriations Bill is expected to move to the Senate floor in the coming weeks and then hopefully will be reconciled with the House passed version and implemented later this fall. We're continuing to work closely with USDA as they implement the 2018 Farm Bill, and that sign up is underway now for producers for the 2019 crop. And so we urge producers to visit their county FSA office and begin making those decisions between ARC and PLC election and then enrolling in the program.
For AgNet West Radio Network, I'm Brian German.
Some agronomists are a little wary of technology, but others say they should adopt it. There are crop advisors that are reluctant to adopt technology as they fear the advancement will replace their position. Farmers Edge CEO Wade Barnes said he had the issue with a senior agronomist until that person realized that technology would allow him to help more farmers.
The senior guy who was pretty nervous about utilizing the machine learning algorithm and eventually got talked into it and then called me up one day and said, I used your machine learning algorithm, and I always like to say use the term yours. I said, so what did you think? And he said, well, it wasn't what I would have done. And I said, so you don't like it? And he said, no. He said, it's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that it isn't what I would have done, but I know those fields. I've known them for 20 years. And you've been talking about me utilizing an assistant, you know, somebody fresh out of school. And he said, I wouldn't trust my farmers with somebody green, but I trust the machine. And that really changed everything for me because that just showcased how machines will scale people up.
Reporting for AgNet West Radio Network, I'm Taylor Hillman.
Well, in today's livestock news, on Tuesday, representatives of the National Pork Producers Council, the National Milk Producers Federation, and the National Corn Growers Association called on U.S. Department of Agriculture to move as quickly as possible to establish a foot and mouth disease vaccine bank. During a press conference, the groups recognized the steps USDA has taken to establish the bank, but called for use of mandatory funding included in the 2018 Farm Bill to purchase the volume of vaccines required to effectively contain and eradicate an FMD outbreak. Currently, USDA, which has prescribed vaccinations for dealing with an FMD outbreak, does not have access to enough vaccine to avoid devastating economic consequences should an outbreak occur here in the U.S. FMD is an infectious viral disease that, of course, affects cloven-hoofed animals. That includes cattle, pigs, and sheep. According to research from Iowa State University, an outbreak here in the U.S. would result in a $128 billion in loss in the beef and pork sectors, $44 billion and $25 billion respectively to the corn and soybean farmers, and job losses of more than 1.5 million across U.S. agriculture for over 10 years. Well, last week, a group of U.S. representatives got together to introduce the Protecting America's Food and Agricultural Act, or H.R. 4482. It would authorize U.S. Customs and Border Protection to hire more agriculture inspectors in order to prevent an outbreak of African swine fever here in the U.S. The bill is a companion to Senate legislation introduced back in July. Now, the National Pork Producers Council has been advocating for an increase in ag inspectors and included the request for 600 additional ag inspectors in its recent fall legislative action conference held in Washington, D.C. McDonald's has announced a fast food restaurant chain is testing a new plant-based burger in Canada, the PLT. A plant lettuce tomato burger launched Monday as a part of a 12-week test up in Canada. The PLT is made with a Beyond Meat plant-based patty. A McDonald's spokesperson said, "We've been working with our recipe, and now we're ready to hear feedback from our customers." McDonald's says the test allows the company to learn more about the real-world implications of serving the PLT, including customer demand and impact on restaurant operations. And Boehringer Ingelheim is developing a biotechnology production site for its veterinary vaccines in Europe. A groundbreaking ceremony held last month marked the start of construction on the site that may become the largest vaccine production facility in the world. The 200 million euro investment will significantly increase production capacities for antigens and vaccines against highly contagious diseases, providing the means to fighting animal epidemics that often have dramatic health and financial consequences, like foot and mouth disease and blue tongue disease. The company says the high security facility will begin operating in France during the third quarter of 2022, and the antigen bank will enable the company to quickly and efficiently respond to government orders in case of an outbreak of foot and mouth disease or blue tongue disease. Boehringer Ingelheim is the second largest animal health business in the world. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West.
This is Farm City Newsday by AgNet West. We'll have more of the day's agriculture news in just a moment. And remember, you can always get the latest agriculture news from across the state and the nation at our website at www.agnetwest.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City News Day. We've got more agriculture news right now.
In the world of nutrition, one phrase that has been thrown around a lot in recent decades is portion control.
Today we're going to talk about portion control.
I lost 160 pounds mainly through portion control.
How to replace your go-to foods with healthier choices and some portion control tricks. The big question in the room tends to be, what is portion control?
That's been food for thought for Diane Tai, who leads a collaborative effort called the Portion Balance Coalition, which aims to bring a new understanding to the idea of portions.
Portion balance, very deliberate in terms of those words, because portion control is often used, and that really is about volume, and we want it to be much more expansive.
Being much more expansive includes making sure each portion is also full of nutritional goodness. To achieve this goal, the Portion Balance Coalition brought together diverse partners, including universities, health groups, the food industry, and USDA.
Bringing together the different players and having the lenses and their voices at the table, I think, has made the difference.
Instead of focusing only on children, the coalition is looking at young adults who are putting on weight as they go through life changes.
If you're struggling with your weight as a young adult, it's challenging to then make sure you're feeding your children well. So if we focus on young adults, we could potentially be hitting two targets.
Also, people are eating out more, which means restaurants and food providers need to be part of the discussion.
And we want to work with the industry to say, you know, what is your role in moderating those portions if we're actually seeing that we have this overweight and obesity crisis on our hands.
At the same time, volume is still a major factor, as restaurant portion sizes have grown in recent years. Portion sizes are based on how much food a person is actually eating, but serving size is how much a person should be eating. This is where USDA comes in.
USDA Center for Nutrition Policy and Promotion has developed MyPlate, which is a consumer translation of the dietary guidelines. So it takes the key principles and it translates it into language that meets consumers where they are.
Stephanie Fu is with the Center for Nutrition Policy and Promotion, which provides consumers with details about recommended serving sizes.
When you go to myplate.gov, there is a whole range of resources. There are tip sheets, there are tools to use. You can find out by plugging in basic information how much you need personally from each of the food groups.
She applauds the Portion Balance Coalition for approaching the issue positively.
Food is something that we all should enjoy. We all need it, but it's also something that would be nice to enjoy. And so that is very much the kind of tone and spirit of what we're trying to do here.
This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Storing fruits and vegetables properly for winter. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. Some fruits and vegetables, when stored away properly, can last for months, as is. No canning necessary, no picking, no fermenting. Potatoes, for example, they are easy to grow and store fresh for months. To store them properly, they should be harvested before temperatures get freezing. They should be cured out of the sun in a moist place for about 2 weeks, then stored in covered boxes or baskets in a relatively humid place, such as a basement or root cellar. The trick is to let them stay cold but never freeze. 50 degrees Fahrenheit is ideal. Onions store well in a box or burlap sack in a cool, humid place. Garlic bulbs, too, will store for months. They should be harvested when a little over half the leaves are still green and, like onions, cured in a hot but shaded place with plenty of ventilation. Trim the tops back about 4 inches each week. Squashes and pumpkins can be stored for several weeks, too, if they are harvested ripe and a bit of the stem remains. Store them in baskets, shallow containers, or just on shelves in the basement. Sweet potatoes should be harvested when it's still warm, cured in hot, humid place for a couple of weeks, then stored in the warmest part of the food cellar. Some apples will store throughout the entire season if handled carefully, and root vegetables will store well when harvested prior to a hard freeze. The green tops are trimmed down to about a half an inch, and the roots are packed into moist sand in a sealed container in the refrigerator. I'm Kathy Isom for AgNet West.
Good day, everybody. Albert J. Hernandez, the Untamed Chef for AgNet West. Welcome to the California Kitchen, where you can learn how to cook from an award-winning chef in under 3 minutes or less. I'm your host with the most. Let's get untamed. My recipe today is a recipe I'm not sure a lot of people have had, but I promise you, my inspiration for this recipe came from a recent dinner with my beautiful wife at Bouchon Restaurant in Yountville, California. I'm talking about escargots with puff pastry. Yes, escargots are snails. Yes, they are delicious, and no, they're not super hard to make. They're very, very easy to make, so let's get started. The very first step I need to do is I'm going to set my oven to 400 degrees. Now, very simply, what I'm going to do is take my puff pastry sheets, and I'm going to fold them in half, and then I'm going to fold them again, and I'm going to cut out circles, just using a small circle cookie cutter or a cutter, whatever you call it. If you don't have circle, that's fine. You can just use a knife and cut squares, but I want it to look really, really nice. We're gonna butter those just with some spray butter. You could do the egg method if you want to do the egg yolk method and really get that eggy, you know, drizzle on top of that, and then you can rub that in with a brush. However, the butter method works really good for puff pastry because puff pastry's already got a lot of fat in it, so add a little more fat, it's gonna be great. With our snails, now you can have the snails already pre-cleaned. You don't have to just get snails that are still in a shell. I promise you that's not the case at all. You always want to make sure you at least give them a rinse, and then once you give them a rinse, go ahead and pat them down dry. Now the texture of the snail is going to be kind of slimy, but I promise you once this cooks up, it's almost like a really creamy mushroom. It's fantastic. We're going to take 8 snails. I only have 8 snails because there's 4 people in my family, remember. But these things, easy. You can eat probably 8 to yourself. They are so, so good. We're going to put those into a medium-high heat saute pan. I'm going to add 2 tablespoons of butter, 2 tablespoons of garlic, a splash of Chardonnay, and a tablespoon of heavy cream. We're going to put those individually. If you have like a cupcake mold, you can use those definitely. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to put them in, and then I'm going to put the puff pastry right on the top. And very simply, I'm going to put it in the 400 to 450 degree oven. If you're doing a convection oven, stay at 400. If you're doing a non-convection, go to 450. We're going to let these cook for 10 minutes, pull them out. And the way you eat these is just using a deep spoon. What you want to do is be able to grab the escargot and also grab the puff pastry at the same time and eat it in one bite. Now remember, they are going to be hot, so be very, very careful. For this and many more of my Untamed recipes, pop-up dinners, and all sorts of things Untamed, go to my website, www.ajtuntamedchef.com. And as always, this is Albert J. Hernandez. You all know me as the Untamed Chef from AgNet West.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. We'll be right back. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City News Day. I'm Danielle Leal. In today's interview segment, we take a listen to our friends over at the Vineyard Team talk with Gregory Jones, who is the director of Evenstead Center for Wine Education. He specializes in climate structure on sustainability for viticulture. Let's take a listen to what he has to say about the impacts of climate change on wine production in part two of this interview.
Now, just to speak about one of your fantastic accomplishments here, I know you were a contributing author to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, which received a Nobel Peace Prize, and that was back in 2008. So speaking about trends, tell us a little bit how things have changed in your perspective on climate change from then to now.
Sure. So, I'm going to go back to that whole IPCC process. Number one, I contributed, but I was only one of 3,000 authors. The climate scientists that contributed to that were, all over the world. And I think every one of them deserves a little fragment of that Nobel Peace Prize. You know, Al Gore gets a lot of credit for it because he publicized it in a different way. But there's a lot of scientists that contributed to that. And, if you look at kind of the past of the IPCC process and where we are today with it, you know, that governing body has really done a great job helping the public to better understand what we know about climate science. And our knowledge of that has grown immensely. We've become more sure of our data and the trends that it's telling us. We've become better at attributing what we can see in some of those trends in climate to certain factors. And there's some things we still don't know everything about, but our knowledge base is definitely changed. The other thing that's changed is that back when I first got started in the late 80s, early 90s, I think that there was still quite a bit of the science that was kind of on the fence about the human contribution to climate change. So the idea that can humans play a role in this, I think it was still kind of a 50-50 deal. And today, it's no longer in that framework. I saw some just the other day that said in the most recent survey of 3,000 geoscientists worldwide, 97% say that humans are clearly playing a role in the climate today. And so, that plus many other pieces of evidence, really are telling us that humans have this role. And, the important piece of this, too, is that it's not just fossil fuels. A lot of people tend to kind of focus that as being the main driver, and it may be one of the main drivers, but it's really the sum total of what 6 to 7 billion people do by changing the energy budget of our planet and its atmosphere. Anything we do, from desertification to deforestation to urbanization, all of those are players as well. And so we need to look at this, I think, much more holistically and understand it's the sum total that we contribute to potential changes in climate. And then how can we best mitigate and adapt around those things that we inherently do?
Now, as director and faculty member at Linfield, what do you think is the role for academia moving forward with regards to helping our industry address these very serious changes moving forward?
Well, I think I've always viewed this, really it comes down to one word, to be aware. There's a little bit of a story behind this. Weather and climate are one of those things that everybody seems to know everything about. It's kind of like politics. You know, you talk to somebody and they all know what the temperature is. And of course, you're talking about politics and they all know what the problems are. But when you really dig down to into the nitty-gritty of it, it really is something that we truly don't necessarily know the underlying framework behind it. And weather and climate is clearly that. You know, I can go somewhere and talk about climate change, and if it's, you know, a really warm week or a really warm day or a warm season, I could be viewed as being brilliant. But if I go somewhere and it's just been a cold day, a blizzard, coldest winter on record, I know that I'm questioned much more. And so, you know, we have to really think about kind of how we are aware of what's happening around us. Because when anybody tells somebody, well, you know, the trend in temperature in your region has been, you know, 1.5 degrees in the past 50 years, that's kind of a hard thing. Number one, people don't often really relate to what is a trend and what does 1.5 really mean? And is it in the average or is it in the maximum or the minimum? And how does that relate to kind of my life or the life of a salamander in the woods or, you know, a flower in my garden? You know, so I think that there's a real awareness that academia has, both educating students to understand the totality of the framework behind all this, but also to provide industry with hopefully objective ways of looking at data and information that tell us or give us maybe just some insights into what does this all look like and what's happening around me.
You know, you mentioned earlier degree days, and for our listeners that aren't as familiar with that term, it basically describes the light and heat of any region in a given year. And obviously, that's a big concern as climate continues to drift and change, and we're getting warmer areas in some and a little maybe some cooler areas. Obviously, that is going to be a big pressure on the suitability of grapes in certain regions. But then I think about issues like pests and invasive species being able to move into new territories because of climate change. And really, it's more than just about temperature and weather. It's about everything in our ecosystem that relies on these factors for boundaries and for suitability. Do you see any of these challenges being of concern moving forward?
Well, yeah, of course, the framework of looking at, you know, disease and pest issues, we really have to look at the human component as well as the climate component. Of course, you know, diseases and pests travel around with humans in many different ways and forms. And so we have to consider how we're kind of somewhat agents of our own destruction in
sure.
some ways.
Yeah.
Moving plant material around, you know, moving products around that typically can carry things. So we have those issues clearly. But on the other side of it, the climate component of it, even if humans are taking a new insect into or an insect in from one region to another, the climate has to be conducive, number one, for that insect or maybe that disease, bacterium, virus to proliferate. So you have to have this climate capability, but there also has to be an ecological kind of niche for that pest or that disease to proliferate. So, for example, you know, organisms like, well, a great example that just came to my head was our fire ants. Fire ants in Central and South America have historically been you know, they've always been there, but they've always been in check because there's been something else that has been in competition with them. You bring fire ants to, you know, the southeastern United States, back when bananas first started making their way over, those fire ants came here and didn't have anything that was a natural mechanism to keep them at bay. So they took off. And, you know, that's only one of, you know, dozens of different kinds of issues like that, where the ecological niche of an insect could be such that it's brought to a given area, the climate is conducive, and all of a sudden there's nothing competing against it, and they take off.
Yeah, exactly. So this year we've had a little bit of an abnormal winter and spring, fairly cool and a fair amount of precipitation. What are you seeing in your region this year so far?
Well, I have to go back to what you said, fairly cool. Do you realize that all of your listeners will think it's been a cool year? But do you realize that in a relative sense, comparing it to the last 30 to 50 years, mm-hmm. it's still in a top 10% year?
Wow.
I write reports the first of every month for the Western U.S. I have about 3,000 or 4,000 people who subscribe to this. And I write basically a weather and climate summary for the Western U.S. that looks at the month that was, the season that we're in, conditions, and then gives a short forecast. And right now, looking at the data for the month of July, it was right at the average of the 1981 to 2010 30-year climate normal average. Parts of California have been above average. Parts of Washington have been above average. But everybody has been more closer to average. And so I like to say we're near average, not cooler. Does that make sense?
It sure does. And it brings a lot of perspective to when you, you know, look around and you think that it's a cool year. It's all relative, isn't it?
Again, to hear the whole interview, you can visit vineyardteam.org. This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. More agriculture news and farm features are coming up. Welcome back to AgNet West Farm City News Day. We've got more agriculture news right now. An animal disease expert says African swine fever's ability to hitchhike is one reason it's been able to continue to spread across Asia and Europe. USDA's Gary Crawford has the report.
African swine fever, a disease of swine and not people, continues to spread across Asia with the latest cases reported in South Korea. Now, experts tell us as a virus, ASF's not that terribly contagious on its own, but the Agriculture Department's chief veterinarian, Dr. Jack Shear, says it is spreading because it's an excellent hitchhiker.
If there's contact with an animal that has the virus, or people move implements or food or farm equipment around from infected areas to non-infected areas, they can spread it. So it's carried on clothes, carried by people on their boots, so they can bring it to hogs.
Which is why he says very tight biosecurity at pig farms and hog slaughter facilities is so important, and also why rapid reporting of and rapid response to reported cases is so vital. Over this past week, the USDA and animal health agencies in several states have been running functional drills to, among other things, clock response times and improve them.
That was USDA's Gary Crawford reporting. And in more news, the U.S. Forest Service and Job Corps are teaming up. USDA's Stephanie Ho has this report.
A recent Commerce Department report said the outdoor recreation economy contributed 2.2% to the nation's gross domestic product in 2017.
The statistic of 2.2% might sound small, but it is interesting to note that it is growing almost 50% faster than general GDP.
Associate Chief of the U.S. Forest Service, Lenise Lago, testified before a House subcommittee.
15 states across the country now have recreation officers, so showing that states recognize the importance of this recreation economy.
Meanwhile, she pointed to her agency's efforts to improve its infrastructure, which leaves plenty of room for opportunity.
The condition of deteriorated infrastructure means we can't provide access or we can't provide a full season of use to many users of national forest lands.
This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can follow AgNet West on Twitter and Facebook with @AgNetWest. Follow Brian German with @BrianAgNetWest, Danielle Leal with @DLealAgNetWest, and Taylor Hillman with @TheManOfTheHill. This has been Farm City News Day by AgNet West.